Welcome, everyone. Episode 435 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and today we're going to break down where we stand with every second round series and which adjustments the teams need to make to get back into the series. We'll also talk about Neil Olshey's press conference and where that leaves the Portland Trailblazers with regard to Damian Lillard in particular. Before we get into all that, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews. We're being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. And we're recording our show today on Locker Room, the only live audio social network for sports fans. Listen to our show on Locker Room before it hits your iTunes feed. Engage with us in real time, or start your own room to react to the draft, trade news, and more. Take the mic and download Locker Room in the Apple App Store. Joining me today is someone who is going to be probing the free agent point guard market for the next 2 months, Morten Jensen. How's it going?
It's going well, Brian. How about you?
I am doing well. I am sad about Danny Green, which we'll get to a bit later, but we have a lot to get through. So let's just jump right in, Mort. We're going to just go in order of the series. We're recording this on Saturday afternoon. So the first one coming up is tonight. We have Jazz Clippers. The Clippers find themselves in a familiar situation, down 2-0. The good news is they didn't lose those two games at home. So they are coming home for game three. But much like their first round series, they now need to win four of the next five to advance to the conference finals.
Yeah.
I think the number one story of this series has been Donovan Mitchell. He has been absolutely sensational in both games. And the Clippers, much like they did early in that series against the Mavericks, they just have not seemed to have a good answer for Donovan Mitchell, despite having Kawhi Leonard and Paul George. So, Mort, that's where we're starting. How, if you're the Clippers, do you not stop Donovan Mitchell, but at least slow him down a little bit?
That's a really good question. I wonder if this was one of their ideas. Like, maybe if they just kind of let Donovan go crazy, maybe that would kind of negate everyone else, and then it just completely backfired. I mean, that's just me spitballing. I have no idea, because when I've seen these games, it just seems like the Clippers aren't really... what's the word I'm looking for there? Like, the Jazz are in control all the time, and it seems they just know exactly when to punch. They know exactly when they need to assert themselves. It's one of those series where you're... I don't think I want to say I would be shocked to see the Clippers get back into it, but I'm at that point at least where I'd be surprised. I'd be surprised to see them come back and win, like you said, four out of five. Like, can they turn this into a six-game series? Probably, maybe. But then both their guys, Kawhi and Paul George, and the supporting cast, they just need to go absolutely crazy for at least two games. We need the Kawhi from the Dallas series. We need to have Paul George just go in fuego. We need Luke Kennard to keep doing what he's doing. Reggie Jackson to keep doing what he's doing. Like, everybody needs to step up. And then there's the other side of that coin. Can you rely on a Clippers team having four or five guys step up offensively when you, as the Utah Jazz, have the defense that you do? I don't think you can. This Jazz roster is just so well-rounded, no?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, they're just executing their system that they have been all year. And the Clippers, even though I would think, again, with Paul George and Kawhi Leonard, they have the defensive personnel to harass Donovan Mitchell, particularly with Mike Conley having missed these first two games. You know, going into the series, that was one of the big questions was, you know, he hurts the hamstring. Is he going to be ready for game one? Now it's a question of, is he going to be ready at all? I mean, he's already been declared out for game three. So you figure, you know, if you told me before the series that Mike Conley would miss the first three games, I would tell you the Clippers need to be up at least 2-1 to realistically have a chance to win this series. And it feels like they just blew two golden opportunities. I mean, both games have been pretty close, at least in terms of the final score. But, you know, it just feels like the Jazz in the fourth quarter both times just absolutely slammed the door on the Clippers. They just feel, in terms of execution, they feel more in control. They feel like they are dictating the terms of this series, and the Clippers are just trying to keep up. And
right.
And I, you know, I'm looking at the matchup data on NBA.com, and it's I'm left with a similar question that I was during much of that Dallas series, which is, you have Paul George and Kawhi Leonard. Why are these two guys not the ones who are the two primary defenders on Donovan Mitchell? I just don't. I get switching. I understand all of that. But you have, like, this is the point of having two elite perimeter defenders. And it feels like until they just completely release the hounds and say, you know what? We are not going to let Donovan Mitchell average 40 points per game in this series. And we're, like, if Joe Ingles beats us, cool. That's fine. If Rudy Gobert beats us offensively, great. But we are not going to let Donovan Mitchell do it. And so far, they have not made that strategic decision.
Yeah, and also they haven't forced the ball out of his hands. I mean, he has six turnovers in two games, and some people, like, you know, would say, well, three turnovers per game, that's a pretty high margin. Well, no, because you have to take into account the usage rate and the amount of minutes that he plays. Like, his turnover percentage this series is only 8.6, which is an utterly elite number. So you're not forcing the ball out of his hands. You're not limiting his shot selection or shot amount. Let me just look up it up here. I think he had 59 field goals. So the first two, was it 59? Yep.
Yeah.
There we go. I mean, that's practically 30 shots per game. So they're not taking the ball out of his hands. They're not limiting shots. They're just basically letting him do whatever, which I guess is a similar approach to what they did Luka in round one. Although you could, of course, make the argument that Luka is just so much more well-rounded just because of his playmaking and all of that than Donovan. But I also think it comes back to Matt Moore of the Action Network came out with a tweet, which I really think hammers home this issue as well. So Donovan Mitchell is so aggressive when he sees a mismatch. Like, when he's got someone on him, he just goes completely in on it. Like, I am going to absolutely murder you for trying to do this thing.
And for daring to put Reggie Jackson on me for even a single possession.
Right. So when you have that guy just chasing that to that extent, I wonder if they just kind of reached the conclusion, the Clippers that being, saying, you know what, we're not going to slow him down. He is going to assert his will in some capacity. We need to get everyone else, like, slowed down. That said, it hasn't really worked for him. Let me just read you something here. So outside of Donovan Mitchell, who has a true shooting percentage of 64.7 this series, Jordan Clarkson is at over 63. Bojan Bogdanovic is almost at 68. Joe Ingles at almost 57. Rudy Gobert at almost 64. Royce O'Neal almost at 64. Like, that is a lot of complimentary guys who are coming in, hitting shots, getting the most out of their offensive opportunities. And if the Clippers can't stop that, then I think that's a bigger issue than just trying to hone in on Mitchell and go, well, we need to shut you down. Well, sure, but if Gobert gets open layups or dunks, and if Royce O'Neal gets open shots, and, like, Jordan Clarkson can just go ape, like, nah, that's not good enough. That's not good enough. This is a whole team. And I don't know if this is a perception thing, Brian. Like, the Jazz are just so much better an offensive team than they used to be. And I don't know if teams just hasn't really updated their software on just how good, how competent the Jazz have become offensively, that they still kind of pigeonhole them a little bit as this defensive-oriented unit. Like, no, these guys can score the basketball even without Mike Conley, for crying out loud. Like, this would have been a slaughter, in my opinion, if Conley had played. Like, I understand they only have won this series so far by a total of 9 points, but like you said, it sure as hell doesn't feel like it. It feels like a lot more. They felt like in control. I just don't know what to do here. And maybe the answer for the Clippers is to kind of attack fire with fire and just go all in on offense. Like, that was part of what we said in the Dallas series. We were kind of like going, you know, Kawhi needs to do a little bit more. And then he ended up having literally an all-time series. I think he broke several records just in terms of, like, scoring average and scoring efficiency. And now, here in the first two games against the Jazz, he's, like, at 22 points per game, which, you know, that's great. It's not what it was against Dallas. Like, you probably need to get up on that threshold before you can even put a dent into this thing. So Paul George, Kawhi Leonard, you're absolutely right. They need to take more time on Donovan Mitchell, but at the same time, they also just need offensively to be so much more on at all times. Like, these guys right now are combining for about 45 points per game. That needs to be 55, 65.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Paul George and Kawhi Leonard have a combined 91 points in this series so far. Donovan Mitchell alone has 82. Kawhi Leonard has 44. Jordan Clarkson has 42.
Oh, boy.
Now, I mean, if you're taking the Clippers' optimistic perspective here, is that Jordan Clarkson is not going to continue shooting above 50% from three-point range in this series. Like, that is bound to regress to the mean. So
presumably, yes.
Yeah, so that's one thing that you can at least maybe hang your hat on.
Right.
But at the same time, you're totally right. I mean, Paul George is shooting 34.3%. Kawhi's shooting efficiently, just hasn't gone into Terminator takeover mode yet. Right. So, and then Marcus Morris has just been abysmal. You know, 32 overall, 1 of 14 from three. So if the Clippers start shooting, I mean, they were one of the best three-point shooting teams in the regular season. They're at 37.5%, so not terrible, but well below their regular season average. If that regresses to the mean, maybe they do get back into the series. I do want to ask you, what did you think about, you know, they started small in game one with Batum in there. They benched him for Zubac in game two to counter Gobert's size. What did you think of that adjustment, and do they, you know, which version of the Clippers starting lineup would you go with moving forward?
I would go with whatever wins. And frankly, I don't think there is one. Well, actually, I do think there is one. I just don't think it's available because Serge Ibaka right now is out for the rest of the year because of back surgery.
Yeah.
That was the key for me. The fact that he just is not going to see the floor, I think he would have been the absolute best player to put in there against Rudy Gobert because of his floor stretching ability. I honestly really don't think it made all that much of a difference in totality. Like, Zubac is a big body. He can bang with Gobert to a certain extent. He's a fine post defender. But what does that really give you when Gobert is more of an opportunistic scorer? Like, that's just kind of lost on me. And he's not going to give anything offensively against Gobert, who is, like, the best defender we have in the entire world. So I would much rather just have the spacing component. I know he's been dreadful. You just brought it up. I would much rather just see Marcus Morris take over that center spot full time, like go in to be sort of a pseudo Serge Ibaka. And like you said, you know, Nicholas Batum started game one, was benching game two. I don't think they're going to revert it back to the game one, but I still want to see that a little bit more just because it didn't work in game one. I don't think it should be abandoned entirely. I would much rather have a perimeter oriented team going against the Jazz, because if you go, you know, mano a mano inside, you're going to lose that matchup. Like, he's been scoring well, but it's Rudy Gobert. Like, can you really put so much on Zubac going, well, we need you to be our primary interior defender. We need you to go get like 15 points per game. Like, no, you can. Not against Rudy. Like, that's just not in play. So I would revert back to game one, and that, I don't think that happens. I don't remember a scenario where I've seen a coach go, all right, let me make an adjustment. Oh crap! That didn't work. Let me go.
Yeah, right.
So I don't. I think. I think like they're probably gonna keep starting Zubac, but I just don't really see the point. Like, even if he comes in like off the bench, like obviously he'll start, but even if he plays the vast majority of his minutes against, you know, someone like Derek Favors, like Favors is a good defender too. I don't know what the benefit is.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the thought process was at least we can't let Gobert completely kill us on the glass. Like, right. We can't let him just absolutely dominate and pull. I mean, it wasn't offensive rebounds, but, you know, he has 20 defensive rebounds or 28 defensive rebounds so far in this series. So, you know, I understand it from that perspective, but I agree with you. You're not going to turn to Zubac as a primary source of scoring. You're not going to have him go one-on-one against Gobert. So it's like the value he provides is as a rebounder and as a rim protector, but that's about it. And what you lose in terms of spacing, especially against a Jazz team that can shoot the hell out of the ball, I think you're right. You almost have to look at this Jazz team and say, look, they're averaging almost 20 made threes per game.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to have to fight that fire with fire, and Zubac is not that type of player. Like, you just have to hope that Marcus Morris at some point turns it around. But Batum's a, you know, not a high volume 3-point shooter, but he at least gives you that spacing element. Luke Kennard has off the bench as well. So
Start Luke Kennard.
I think you'd want a little more size, but maybe, yeah.
Well, honestly, you need an offensive explosion as well. And I think we can both pretty much agree that Luke has a higher chance of at least going hot than Nick Batum. Like, yeah, and he's a good pick and roll player. You can give him the ball and actually initiate plays.
But I wonder if that leaves your bench so devoid of scoring threats, because then you're working with like Batum,
right.
Rondo, you know, like Kennard needs to be that. Not that they're going to lean too heavily on their bench either way. I mean, Paul George is averaging more than 40 minutes per game in the series. Kawhi is 37. So like one of those guys is going to be on the floor the whole time, and they're going to be the main offensive focal point when they are. But I do think Kennard off the bench is that like spark plug six man at least.
Yeah, like I don't that whole spark plug idea, like I get it, but like you said, if one of their primary guys are virtually on the court at all times and they are just kind of staggering them a little bit, I don't think it's a problem. Like it's at no point is Luke Kennard going to be your best offensive option on the floor. And I just kind of want them to see, I want to see them lean into that experience a little bit more. So far, he's done well over the course of this series, shooting the ball at the very least. He does have a pick and roll game. Like hell, when he was at Duke, he was one of the best, statistically speaking, one of the best pick and roll players in the entire nation. He's obviously one of the best shooters in the league. Like, I think you need that. If the NBA playoffs show us something every single year, it is that self-creation and creation for others is at a premium. So you actually have a guy like that here and you're not using him. That to me does not make sense. Like, okay, fine. If you want to keep that off the bench, you don't want to start him. Like, I'm good with that, but then at least up his minutes. Instead of him averaging sub 20 minutes per game, have him average 30. Like, have that consistent presence in there, because if you're looking at a more like determined Kawhi or a more determined Paul George, that's going to suck in the attention. And if that means leaving less room for Kennard on the perimeter, that's buckets.
Yeah. So what is your updated prediction for this series? We didn't even actually preview this series because we recorded before Clippers-Mavericks Game 7. So I guess what going into the series, pretend that you don't know the Jazz are up 2-0. Which team would you have favored going in, and what is your updated prediction now?
What I also have known that it seems like Mike Conley won't even play this series.
No.
Because that kind of matters.
It does. It does matter.
I honestly don't know. I mean, I still think the Clippers have the two best individual players in this series.
Yeah.
Well,
George and Gobert is close.
Yeah, I kind of want to run that back. It felt wrong as it left my lips.
Yeah, well, they definitely have the best player in the series.
Yeah, let's stick with that, with Kawhi. Yeah. You're right, because you know what? I love Paul George, but you're absolutely right. Like, Rudy Gobert is at that level now. Donovan Mitchell, offensively speaking, like, he's right there. We actually have to go back to Mitchell because I have a point I want to make, but let's just hold up on that. Like, yeah, Kawhi is the best player, but it also feels like if you just take Kawhi and Paul George in some sort of player ranking, then it's like, you know, Kawhi is number one, and then you could argue it's like Rudy Gobert, Paul George, Donovan Mitchell, and then there's like all Jazz players for the next five to six spots before we find a Clipper. And because of that depth and because of the way that they just found this balance this year, I think I would have leaned Utah, but at the same time, I also know that I have a complete boner on for, you know, with the way Kawhi plays. But he is. Like, you saw in that Dallas series, like, he was phenomenal.
Yeah.
He was outstanding. Like, when he plays like that, I think it's fair to actually bring him into that conversation of, is he one of the best top tier guys in the entire league? Because he's so influential. But you just need guys to show up the deeper into the playoffs you get, and they aren't. So I'm leaning Utah before, and I'm definitely leaning Utah now, because they're just the kind of caliber of team they are. So let me just talk about Donovan Mitchell, because something has hit me, and it's actually something that spurned a thought from the Philly-Atlanta series. So you know how Bogdanovich is just a playoff player, right? He is one of those 16-game players and all that. It got me thinking, just in terms of this, like, Donovan Mitchell is also one of those guys. Like, he's a 16-game player, and people still evaluate him so much on the basis of the regular season. And I'm just like, I've reached that point where, do you think the next big evolution in the NBA, especially in free agency and these kind of matters, they go way more into, well, how are you as a playoff performer? Instead of, you know, regular season. Like, another example was Montrezl Harrell from the Lakers. Like, he has just been dreadful in the playoffs for two straight years. Like, he to me seems like a regular season player and not anything more than that. And I think that should be reflected in the level of compensation, but it's not. Like, teams still like, oh, he's a pick and roll guy. Like, great, let's give him a bunch of money. Like, no, right? Like, you want to prioritize, financially speaking, the players who deliver in the playoffs, no?
We will revisit that discussion in the Philly-Atlanta series, because I have a take about one of the players who is who could fit in that bucket and is up for a big payday this summer as well.
Oh, I know where you're going with that. But like, just to wrap up Mitchell, like, he is such a 16-game player that I think the entire NBA community is underrating him on the basis of what he's doing in the regular season.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I mean, he's been sensational now this year and last year. Like, in years past, it was just he didn't have enough help. You know, you were saying earlier about Luka and, you know, how they were the Clippers' defensive strategy against him. The problem, if, you know, change or bring that over to this series, is that Utah's supporting cast is much more trustworthy than Dallas's.
Right.
So they can't do that, because the Jazz do have other guys who can beat you. I actually, especially if you told me before the series that Conley was going to miss the first three games, I probably would have leaned the Clippers slightly in this series.
Okay.
And I'm not ruling them out, because we saw they overcame a 2-0 deficit in the first round. But I just think this Jazz team is so damn good. And, like, you know, we've been trying to talk ourselves into the Lakers and the Clippers all year. And it just feels like we are destined for a Jazz Suns finals or, you know, Western Conference finals. And the sooner that we all accept that, the better. Because they were the two best teams in the West, and they deserve to be in the conference finals. So odds makers from the FanDuel Sportsbook have the Jazz right now as a -460 favorite. So they, not like a commanding favorite for a team that's up 2-0, but if they win tonight's game, they will be, you know, where Denver and Phoenix is, which we'll get to in a little bit.
Well, if the Jazz or the Suns make it to the NBA Finals, we absolutely need the Nets to make it for one reason. Ed Jordan has to beat them.
There you go. All right, let's move on to the Bucks Nets. Speaking of the Brooklyn Nets, this one also looked like, after game two, it looked like this was on pace for a very quick series. And then and then we went right back to the early 1990s for a rock fight in game three. The Bucks win 86-83 in one of the lowest scoring games you'll see all season.
What happened with Bruce Brown at the end?
Oh, man. Yeah. Well, he played hero ball. I mean, it was a broken play. Yeah. And, you know, he probably figured this is the best we're going to get. But no, that was not. You that still had time on the clock. Yeah. No, that
was not like, I'm not out on him, but that was just one of those where, like, I would imagine he had a tough time sleeping that night.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's been really good in this series otherwise. Exactly. I do not want to sleep. If anyone should have a hard time sleeping, it was Joe Harris, who just missed a ton of wide open shots, especially late in that game, that could have ended it. I want to ask two questions about this series because the Bucks are still down 2-1.
Yeah.
The first of which, I feel like this was the topic du jour throughout and after the game. Like, just a ton of Giannis slander, particularly about his shot selection. 3 of 16 from 3 in this series. What do you make of the Giannis shot selection discussion?
Well, so we had a couple people in our DM segment
yes,
that started throwing out Russell Westbrook comps, and I'm not there. I think that is just too far gone. I think it is perfectly reasonable to be super weirded out by him taking 8 threes. I think the pull-up three-pointer needs to die a horrible, horrible death right in his hands. Because here's the thing, he's just bailing out the defense. Whenever he takes that shot, even if he hits it, Brian, like, it's one of those shots that just go, that's okay, then he'll miss his next five. Right. Like, it's not one of those things where he catches rhythm and he just goes, like, on a 6-for-8 tear. Like, that doesn't happen. It's just such a low percentage play. And you know what? I am fed up with him having to initiate the offense 30 feet out and going in. Like, become the screener. Rim roll. Cut. Like, Giannis Antetokounmpo, in theory, should be the best off-ball cutter the league has ever seen. Think about it. He's got the length. He's got the athleticism. He's got the first step. He's got the long legs, which means he covers a hell of a lot of ground. Like, if he just gets a step on a defender and he can spin off of that guy, that's an alley-oop play. That's a cut right in to the paint where guys can find him. And yet, they're asking him continuously to create on the perimeter. I don't get it. I don't get what their end goal here. And this is the third year in a row we're seeing this. The one thing I will slander, I don't think it's slander, I would critique Giannis for, is why is he suddenly afraid of Blake Griffin? I understand Griffin has found like a resurgence in Brooklyn, but let's not kid ourselves here. This isn't 22-year-old Blake Griffin anymore. If you have him on you, you should absolutely own that matchup every single night. What the hell did Blake say or do that got into his head? I'll never know.
Yeah. Well, it was weird because like, they started the game and he was attacking the rim relentlessly. And then as the game went on, it just seemed like he started settling more and more.
Yeah.
And you're totally right. It is bailing out the defense every time. Like, you know, this is a completely separate conversation, but I know people were starting like the Ben Simmons comparisons throughout the game too. And, you know, every like Philly fan was like, well, if you criticized Giannis for taking him, you don't criticize Ben for not taking him. It's like, yeah, you want them to just add that to their game. It's similar to what LeBron went through early in his career, where he didn't have that shot and defenses could guard him a certain way. And as he became more comfortable as the years went on, all of a sudden that took that option away and he became much more unguardable. So it's like, it's good for Giannis for taking it, especially in the regular season when it doesn't really matter. But once you get to the playoffs and every possession matters, yes, if Giannis is taking 7 or 8 threes a game, the Nets are going to live with that every time. And if he beats, like, if you know what? If he goes 5 of 8 from 3 one night and he beats them because of that, they'll say, good game, do it 3 more times.
Yeah, exactly.
We will live with those odds. So, yeah, I'm with you. I mean, we could save this for the Bucks by Felicia whenever it happens, but you know, I think it raises some larger questions about how far they can go under Mike Budenholzer in particular. I think all of the nice things that we said about Mike Budenholzer throughout that Miami series are going to age like milk throughout this series.
Yep.
'Cause you know, they made a lot of adjustments throughout the regular season, but we just haven't quite seen that same amount of creativity yet. I don't want to bury the Bucks because they did, you know, they held serve in game 3. If they do so again in game 4, they're tied 2-2 going back to Brooklyn, and we still don't know the status of James Harden moving forward in this series. So they're still alive for now, but nothing about that game gave me confidence that they're going to win this series.
Agreed. And one thing also, just to wrap up Giannis specifically, did you see that tweet that kind of went viral about him as a younger player taking three-pointers. Our friend of the podcast, Ty Windish, also picked it up with some Jason Kidd slander.
Oh, yeah.
Yo, but the video itself was really interesting. Like,
yeah.
Because, so here's the thing. For guys like us, like, yeah, we watch the NBA relentlessly and all that, but like, I'll be honest with you, I can't necessarily remember exactly how a guy shot the ball 5 years ago. Like, that's, I think that's unreasonable to expect that. So when I saw that video, I was like, oh, shit. Like, that's true. He actually had a pretty good release point. Like, that shot was not as broken as it is right now. What the hell happened? Like, right now, it's such a load-up shot that there's just no sense of consistent accuracy on it at all. But that video where I don't know how old it was specifically. I think between 4 to 6 years old, somewhere along those lines, right? That was a straight up-and-down shot. The mechanics were extremely consistent. There was a follow through. It was like, it wasn't a Steph Curry shot by any means, but it was one of those shots where you go, oh, that's at least a reliable 35% 3-point shooter right there.
Yeah, it looked fluid. Like, exactly. It wasn't like as herky jerky and robotic as it is now. It just seems like he's so far in his head. I mean, it's the same thing with his free throws too. We saw another 10 second violation called in this game. It's all mental at this point.
Yeah, 31% from the free throw line. And what was it, a couple of years ago, he was all the way up at, let me look it up, I think it was 77, 78 maybe. No, 77. God, like, look at that. Look, he had a 5-year stretch of above 70% from the free throw line. And now he's here.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to do the Giannis slander. I think Giannis is fantastic. But there are some questions here, because if he's in his own head with the three-throw shooting, if he's bailing out defenses with long three-point shots, I think it is perfectly reasonable to ask yourself whether Giannis is... No, of course he's a 16-game player, but, you know, if he is in the top tier of NBA legends who can consistently win the championship, consistently get your team to the finals, can consistently be one of the top NBA performers in the playoffs year in and year out. I think it's absolutely fair to ask that question if these problems are going to persist. And fortunately, I won't have Bucks fans in my mentions about that, because they seem to agree.
they're in a dark place right now. Which is, it's about that time of year. Second round of the playoffs. Yeah. So it's right on time there. Nature is healing.
Yeah. But we agree that he should just be used as a pivot player now. Well, pivot, well, like just 10 foot and in.
So that was my other question, is what is Brooke Lopez's role in this series? And should they be using Giannis more offensively, at least, as a five? Like, should they have him, even at times, just be the biggest player on the floor?
Yeah, I think you should kind of stagger them a little bit, because they still don't have the size, Brooklyn, that is.
Yeah.
I would absolutely force feed the ball into Brook Lopez here and there, because one of the things that we seem to be forgetting is that he was one of the best back-to-the-basket bigs when he started out his career. That game hasn't gone anywhere. He just kind of modernized and became more of a three-point shooter, but he is still down there doing moves and overpowering people and, like, doing sneaky dunks on people. Like, Lopez is still a threat. I just think because of the makeup of the team, he has just been less prioritized from an offensive perspective. And I would absolutely give him the ball for a lot of stretches. Just get it into the paint, draw free throws, get layups. He's an excellent foul shooter, so that matters too. Like, if he gets people in foul trouble, if he can get to the free throw line, that matters. And then when he's tired, he needs a blow, go out, then get Giannis in there. Like, get every single big man in Brooklyn in foul trouble by the second quarter. Just get it into the paint and dunk that ball down the throats. I think that has to be the play, because if you keep spotting up, it's just not going to work. Like, the Bucks as a team for the first three games are shooting 22.7% from range. Like, I understand that the percentages are statistically bound to change.
Yeah.
But we also realize that a playoff series is maximum 7 games. You can absolutely shoot like crap for 7 games.
Yeah.
So I think if we don't see by game four a major offensive shift in how they play, then I think it's game over.
Yeah. Well, I think this is too where Dante DiVincenzo's injury, we mentioned this when he went down, it was not nearly as flashy as Chris Paul or Anthony Davis or Joel Embiid, but they're really missing him in this series because if you have Dante, you can run a Lopez-less lineup where Giannis is playing effectively center and you can have Drew, Dante, Chris Middleton, Giannis, PJ Tucker, and that just feels like it would have a better chance, especially against the Nets without James Harden. Like, they're not taking advantage of their size. You have Giannis, you have Middleton, you have PJ Tucker, you have Brook Lopez all in your starting lineup, but you're just spacing PJ Tucker out to the, you know, a corner three, and what, he's shooting 1 of 8 from deep so far this series, so it's not even that much of a threat. Like, you're just giving the Nets places to hide defensively, and that's, you know, that was the concern with the Nets, is that you can, like, their offense is supercharged, and how do we stop this team? But in general, I just think the Bucks' offensive strategy, like, they haven't had a ton of ball movement. They're not forcing a ton of rotations. They're just playing a lot of isolation basketball, which is like you're just bailing the Nets out here. You're not actually challenging their weak spots. So I know, Mort, you were on the Bucks going into this series. How have the first three games affected your perception moving forward?
Oh, it changed my perception tremendously because, I mean, I still believe in my overall theory that this team is built as the best team in the NBA to stop them from a defensive perspective. And I still think an optimized Bucks team, like as we saw in the regular season, would beat the hell out of these Brooklyn Nets, like especially without James Harden. But given that they just cannot execute, like you said, like they can't get the shots, it's bad shot selection, it's ISO basketball. Like if we knew that they would revert into ISO basketball before this series, I would not have picked them.
Yeah.
Like it is so difficult for me to sit here and just go, well, you know, they still have the talent. Like, sure they do, but execution matters, schemes matter, decision making matters, and they have just not followed up on the level of success that they had in the regular season or in the first round for that matter, when it finally looked like they clicked. I am just so out right now on the Budenholzer experiment. I really am. I am not going to give him any more. Like I gave him one more year. I was like, before this season, I was like, give him one more year. Now I gave him that year. It was a whole year of narrative with him going, you know, we're just going to sacrifice wins so we can test new stuff out. It's like, cool. He's got it, like, finally. And then we have these three games that's just been crapola all the way through. Like, what the hell? No, that it absolutely changed my mindset. I don't know where the Bucks go from here. I just don't think there's any cohesion in how they play. And also, like, the PJ Tucker thing. You brought up PJ. We need to have a conversation about something here. It's not PJ specifically driven, but you and I have had this conversation off the podcast before. You know how the NBA has just grown so fascinated with defensive guys who can play like 2-3 positions from a wing perspective. And then there's this coaching mentality. Well, it doesn't matter if you give us a single point. Just go play defense. Like wing guys, defense, yay! This guy is averaging around a point per 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Why is it that we keep penalizing offensive players for not playing defense, but it's all pride and glory if a guy defends but can't score a damn bucket? Like, well, that's wrong, no?
They're playing PJ Tucker to be their Kevin Durant defender. Kevin Durant is averaging 30 points on almost 50% shooting. Like, it's not working. You have the personnel in your starting lineup with Giannis and Middleton. Again, especially without, you know, we said fully healthy Bucks and Nets, you can throw, you know, Drew on Irving, Middleton on Harden, or Middleton on Durant, and Giannis on Harden. Like, you have the personnel in your starting lineup to guard their big three. You're forcing PJ Tucker in, I guess, you know, to not tire Giannis out defensively or tire Middleton out defensively. but it's just not working, and PJ is not giving you anything offensively. But again, this is where, you know, if Dante was healthy, Dante would be starting, and he would at least be more of an offensive threat. So, you know, you could go with, like, Bryn Forbes off the bench or Bobby Portis off the bench, Pat Connaughton, but they just don't have a ton of great options, I think.
Right.
That's the problem.
But honestly, even, like, I understand that they don't have a lot of offensive options. And I'm not specifically talking about PJ here. It's just, it's more the narrative. It's more like the league-wide thing, like teams going into the draft and thinking, we need a defensive wing who can play big, and it's all about defense, defense, defense. What I'm really asking here is, why do we sort of say, yeah, if you're a defender, it's that determination is full of pride. Like, it's a good thing. Defense wins, yada, yada, yada. But if an offensive player is a bad defender, then he gets absolutely slaughtered. Why is it that we have this mindset? Like, if you're bad on one end of the floor, regardless of its offense or defense, that should be considered a net negative. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't understand why we still persist in the year 2021 to glorify guys who can't even hit a damn jump shot. But guys who can go out and get you 30 but may not play a lot of defense are like, no, no, I'm not interested. Move on. Like, what? What are we even doing?
Can I interest you in the Sixth Man of the Year award? Because it tends to reward players who score a lot off the bench. This might be your cup of tea.
No, but you catch my drift, though, right? Yeah. Like, it's...
Unless, like, you need someone to be as defensively impactful as a Matisse Thybulle or, like, prime Tony Allen if they're not going to be... If they're not going to give you anything on offense. PJ Tucker, 35-year-old PJ Tucker, is not that at this point. But, you know, again, I just don't... Like, I guess you could try out Bobby Portis.
Portis. At least what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Like, Tucker is playing almost twice as many minutes as Bobby Portis. And you know why he's doing that? Because coaches love defense. Yeah. Defense, defense, defense. What the hell? Bobby Portis is a guy who can come in, give you 12-7 or something in limited minutes. Go get stats. Like, go get points. Go grab a rebound. Don't just change your damn shoes three times in a game.
Like, I mean, yes, you held the Nets to 83 points, but you only outscored them by 3. And the odds are very...
Yeah.
You know, they missed a ton of open shots. Like, you're not going to hold this team under 100 points very often. So,
that wasn't the Bucks that won that game.
Right. It was the Nets. Yeah. The Nets just, they had a ton of opportunity. And, like, Kevin Durant was just answering every single, you know, Middleton played great after first rough two games. Yep. And he, especially down late in the fourth quarter. But Durant was just answering it every single time. So, yeah, I'm with you, though. I think I would try something new. I would try to get rid of Tucker, Lopez, or someone. But I mean, their favorite, honestly, this is surprising. According to FanDuel Sportsbook, the Nets are a -390 favorite. The Bucks are +295. That is currently the closest series odds-wise of all four. And I just feel like the Nets are I mean, I guess you could argue that all four series feel like they have one team is pretty heavily favored at this point. But I mean, that it just feels very disrespectful from, you know, looking at the total picture of how much Brooklyn has owned the series. I guess it's a testament to Milwaukee's talent more than anything else.
Look, and I appreciate talent. I really do. I think talent at the end of the day is so crucial. But if you apply it incorrectly, or if your coach just completely mismanages the level of talent, it means very little. And look, this is one of the things that I was a little bit worried about. I don't think I ever verbalized it because I was thinking, oh, Mort, you're overthinking it. But like Drew, Chris, and Giannis are like, well, at the very least, Chris and Drew, I think offensively there's a very set ceiling to what they can do. Like, you're not going to have a year of Chris Middleton averaging 28. Mm-hmm. You're not going to have Drew Holiday go through a 20 games, you know, period where he's averaging 25 plus and is shooting like 45% from downtown. Mm-hmm. Like, you're not going to see those things. There's this pretty set ceiling on their offensive games. And I just wonder if when push comes to shove in the playoffs, if you just need someone with a little bit more offensive creation ability, someone who can just get you buckets Like, it sounds so simplistic, but if we look at this series, it feels like they need that. It really feels like Milwaukee just needs a guy who can come in and go, you know what, this isn't working. I'm going to take over for the next 15 minutes, yeah, and I'm going to score 17 points. They don't have that.
They need a Chris Paul.
Or a Zach LaVine.
Ooh, okay. I was trying to transition into the Suns-Nuggets series. But yeah, I mean, we can... I would love to see how they could get LaVine, if they could.
I don't think they can. I'm just saying it's... And I don't think LaVine specifically. I'm just saying they need someone who can just create consistently. Like, but man, if Chris Paul on the Bucks, though, that's... That would have been fun. Now we're just dreaming, but good Lord. How far ahead would they have been right now if Chris Paul was on that roster?
Well, I mean, honestly, if they just didn't open their damn mouths about Bogdan Bogdanovic, they'd be winning this series.
Yep, that too.
That I mean, not to beat a dead horse here, but like, especially seeing how Bogdan has performed in the playoffs.
We'll get there.
Yeah, I mean, that is the chaos element that they really, like, Drew has played really well defensively against Kyrie and made him really work, but has struggled offensively. Bogdan, but it would have been that missing piece, and they really, really...
That's a good point.
Just totally screwed that up.
Yeah.
But let's go into Suns Nuggets now. Mort, you brought this up on Twitter when I picked Suns in five, and a few Nuggets fans took umbrage with me heading into this series. So now, as the Phoenix Suns are up 3-0 and have won every game by double digits, I ask you, what was I missing about the Denver Nuggets, who are now
basically... I didn't say you were missing anything.
I know. But, like, I mean, what can the Nuggets even do here? Like, if Nikola Jokic has the game that he does in Game 3, where he has, like, a 30-20-10 game, and they still lose by double digits,
yeah,
is there anything that the Nuggets can do to get back into this series, or is it really as simple as Jamal Murray is out, they just, you know, they don't have the firepower to keep up?
Well, yes and no. So obviously their guard play right now is just atrocious because they don't have the depth. They just don't. And it, like, I'm not going to put that at the feet of their guards. Like, that's not their fault that Jamal Murray went down with an ACL. So they're doing everything they can. So it's not me trying to crap on their guard rotation. It's just, it's not good enough. And that's what it is. They're playing really well to their best of their abilities. But look, they're going up against Chris Paul, Devin Booker. Like, good luck. You won't win that.
Right.
To me, it comes down to Michael Porter Jr., I think.
Yeah.
Like, he needs to have an insane game 4, right? Like, for them to even win. Otherwise, we're looking at a sweep.
Yeah.
I mean, I was with you. Like, I had the Suns in 6, and now I feel like that was definitely too long of a series I expected there. Like, I thought Nikola Jokic is going to basically Jokic himself into 2 wins. That was my argument.
Mm-hmm.
And like you just said, if he can't win you a game by putting up 30, 20, and 10, I just don't know what he can do. And that means I have to pivot to the rest of the guys. And there's only one guy. Well, actually, there are 2 guys who stands out as being able to do more. It's Porter, but it's also Aaron Gordon.
Yeah,
we'll get to Aaron Gordon. But I'm starting with Michael Porter Jr. because offensively, I think his ceiling is dramatically higher than Gordon. So we need him to come out and average 25. Average, like, this series might be over.
right. But, well, he's averaging 13.7 right now, and he's shooting 35.9 from the field. So, yes, he needs to...
So bad.
And he did hurt his back, to be fair. Like, I don't think he's 100% healthy.
Yeah.
But, yes, if the Nuggets were going to have any chance in this series, yes, you knew what you were going to get out of Jokic. But you also needed at least 20 to 25 out of Porter. Then, as you said, Aaron Gordon has just not... this is like the Aaron Gordon experience in a nutshell.
Yeah. That was what I was fearing with Gordon. Right now, you're getting like the worst-case scenario of Aaron Gordon.
Yeah.
You're getting a guy who offensively is just a non-factor, who isn't really moving the ball a whole lot, who's really standing around. That's not the version we needed here if you're Denver. I think you and I even said before the series started that we needed this to be Orlando Gordon, like coming in and put up those 15, 16, 18 points per game. He just hasn't. He's been very passive. There isn't, like we already said, there hasn't been a whole lot from their guards. Like, okay, Will Barton came back and has played fairly well, I would say. Like, he gave them a little bit of an offensive push. That's great. It's just not enough. Like, I'm looking at this active roster right now, and it is just, Brian, it's so bad.
Yeah. I mean, I said this going into the series. The starting backcourt of Chris Paul and Devin Booker going against Facundo Campazzo and Austin Rivers, it was just such a glaring mismatch that I didn't think Jokic was going to be able to overcome that. Especially going against DeAndre Ayton, who has continued to play very well. You know, he played extremely well in that Lakers series. He's kept it up here as well. And he's not going to stop Jokic, but Jokic is not, you know, he's shooting 46.4 instead of 56. He's shooting 28.6 from three instead of 38. So he is at least making life somewhat more difficult on Jokic. And it's a testament to what the Suns have too. Personnel-wise, they are just they're like the perfect optimized modern lineup where you have these two pick-and-roll guards in Booker and Paul. You have these two 3-and-D forwards in Bridges and Crowder. You have Ayton, who can, you know, this rim-rolling center who's developing defensively and has the size.
Jay Crowder is good right now.
Jay Crowder is hitting shots, which he was not in the first series. Cameron Payne is playing well off the bench. Dario Saric is playing well off the bench. Torrey Craig
is playing well.
Yeah, like, they are just hitting on all cylinders right now. And this is what I was worried about, is that I just thought matchup-wise, the Nuggets, even if you put Aaron Gordon on Devin Booker, you know, in the possessions that he gets switched off, like, they are really going at Michael Porter on defense. And then Campazzo and Rivers had no chance against Chris Paul. Chris Paul just has complete control of this series. He is, like, playing with food right now. He is just toying with, like, how do I want to destroy you guys today?
Yeah. He is on a mission. He knows that his best buddy, LeBron James, has won championships. He's looking to get on that banana boat with a ring.
Yeah, this is his best shot.
This is his best shot, and he is living up to it. But can I just point out one thing about the DeAndre Ayton and Nikola Jokic thing, which I found so interesting?
Mm-hmm.
So when Jokic is outside the three-point line, right, and he's like kind of debating with himself, am I going to pull the trigger or am I going to put the ball on the floor? I don't know. So this is me maybe putting so much on Ayton just in terms of how he's thinking the game out. Maybe it's just sheer coincidence. It's just a pattern I noticed. It seems to me Ayton is positioning himself so beautifully. Like, he's just far away enough to get Jokic thinking, okay, I'm going to pull it. But he also firmly aware that, you know what, I can't go all the way out and be in his face because otherwise he's going to move past me. So when you see Jokic just like leaving his feet, he just extends his arm out, takes that one strong step. So it's like a semi-contest, but it's not necessarily a hard contest. But it's enough to affect Jokic, and it's also enough that he goes back to grab the defensive rebound, or at least competes to get the rebound in play. I don't know if it's Ayton is thinking this all out, but I freaking love it. Like, when you're forcing one of the game's best thinkers to overthink, like, if that is what he's doing, holy crap. Like, one of the things I said before this series, I said that if I'm Nikola Jokic, I'm just not getting into the lane. Like, I'm choosing not to go into post-ups against DeAndre Ayton because I fully know that Ayton is a strong post-up defender. And yet we're seeing Jokic do this. And it's not really working out for him all the time. Like, sure, here and there, he'll get a bucket. Like, he'll maneuver himself into a layup or a tough fadeaway or whatever. Like, okay, fine. You'll live with that. But I thought that Jokic would be so much smarter against this matchup. And he isn't. He hasn't been. Like, has Ayton just figured him out? I don't know. But the more I see from this matchup, the more I'm completely blown away by how he really... Jokic, that is, hasn't really found a way to get past that one matchup and figure it out like a consistent way of, oh, I can beat you mm-hmm. by going this way, or I can beat you going this way, or I can beat you going in a third way. It seems like he is constantly thinking.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like he's pressing a bit.
Yeah.
In part because he knows he doesn't have Murray, who would be his
right.
reliable number two guy. He knows Michael Porter's struggling. He knows Aaron Gordon isn't providing what they need offensively. So he's like, it feels like he's putting this pressure on his shoulders as a scorer, whereas when he's really at his peak, like, he's primarily still the facilitator who just happens to score 25 to 30 points a game. Like,
yeah, he's a point guard.
Yeah, so I think the Murray absence, and then just, I mean, go down the list, like, as a single other rotation player shooting above 50% from the field right now, barely above 45%. I mean, Michael Porter's at 36, Aaron Gordon's at 42, Monte Morris at 34.5. No turnovers, at least. Monte Morris, 4 games with zero turnovers. The full Monte
75
Morris.
Minutes. 75 but, minutes, no yeah, turnovers.
Like,
jeez.
You could probably argue that Will Barton, coming off of this major injury layoff, has been the second best Nuggets player in this series. It's just, it's, I mean, and we'll get to the Nuggets by Felicia very soon at this rate. Like, I don't want them to overreact to this series, because I just think they're, like, you know, they're, it happens.
Right.
They're injured. But, like, we saw them right after the Aaron Gordon trade, when, before Jamal Murray got hurt. I think that's, you know, we're talking about Aaron Gordon needs to provide more offensively. I just don't think this is who Aaron Gordon is at this point. I don't think he's ever going to be this 20-point-per-game scorer, and we just have to, like, get that concept out of our heads, and he can be very effective in this versatile defensive player, short roller. Like, you could be the fourth right. option offensively, which is what he'll be when they have a healthy Jamal Murray. But you shouldn't be paying Aaron Gordon a max or a near max because you think, oh, all of a sudden he's going to take this leap and be, you know, superstar 25 points per game.
Right.
No, he's like, you need him to be a less good version of Draymond Green or Ben Simmons. Like, that is Aaron Gordon's optimized role, I think.
Yeah, but you still need to rely on him offensively. Like, he's still too good not to put points on the board, though. I'm not going to go all P.J. Tucker with him.
No,
I don't
no.
want him to go into that role. I mean, I need him if I'm the Nuggets. I need him to produce points for me in some capacity. If it's opportunistic points playing in the, like, fourth or fifth role, fine. But I need him to be there to grab oops, to take an open three, to take the open mid-range pop. I don't care. He still needs to be there instead of just standing around, though.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we'll see a much better version of him when we see healthy Murray next right. year. I'll put it in this way. The Phoenix Suns are currently a minus 8,000 favorite. The Nuggets are a plus 2,200 to get back into the yeah. series. So I'm not going to ask you if you think the Nuggets are coming back, because they're not. I will ask you.
Yeah, no team has ever come back from 0-3, so, like, no.
Do you think this series goes five, or do the Suns close it out tomorrow night?
I just want it to go five. I want the Nuggets to just get one, but I don't think so.
Yeah. Break out the brooms. This thing is over.
Yeah, I think so too. But I will say this. You said they shouldn't overreact.
Yes.
Just in terms of, like, roster things. That's true. I agree with you. You shouldn't overreact, but you should react.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll get it very yeah. soon at this point. They have some questions to answer, but I don't think it's like, trade everyone, fire Mike Malone. Yeah.
Oh, no, no.
Blow
no,
up the
no,
whole
no.
team. Like,
no.
Just, yeah. All right, so we'll wrap up, in terms of playoffs at least, with the game, first game on Monday night, Sixers-Hawks. The Sixers
yeah, took... I'll just leave, and then you can take over this for the next 35 minutes,
well,
right?
I have some questions for you about this, because this is going to be really interesting to see how game four yeah. plays out. The Sixers, you know, switch Ben Simmons onto Trae Young in game two, and has been just a night and day difference in terms of what Trae Young's been able to produce
obviously.
In those two games.
Yep.
Yeah, so obvious that you wonder, why didn't they do it in game one? The bench has come alive. We saw Shake Milton in game two, Furkan Korkmaz last night. So they're actually yeah. getting production from other members beyond their big three. The two questions I have for you, Mort. Mm-hmm. One, Danny Green leaves very early last night with a calf strain. He is going to be out for 2 to 3 weeks, at least, according to Shams Charani of The Athletic. So Korkmaz replaced him in the starting lineup. If you're Philly, do you stick with Korkmaz as the Danny Green replacement, or do you go with someone else?
Yeah, I think you need the shooting. I really think you need the shooting. And Korkmaz, while he's not a defender, he's a shooter. He's a guy who can really get the ball into the basket. And I think that's crucial to have the more floor spacing, because that opens up driving lanes for Ben. It gives Joel that edge inside. It gives Joe Harris more room to operate. And he has been on a tear just getting to the basket, so I want to optimize that for him. I like Shake, but he has been a little bit inconsistent of late. I know he's been very, very good in this particular series, but I don't know if I'm at that point where I fully rely on him as a starter to provide that. And you're already like shaking your head. Yeah. So I'm going Korkmaz. I don't know what that name is tripping me up today on this one, because I just think you need that immediately. And then I think they have enough firepower coming off the bench. If we expect that Shake is going to remain the consistent scorer he's been. Mm-hmm. Also, Tyrese Maxey, I know he hasn't shot the ball well, but I like his offensive upside. Also, I don't think you can take 25 total minutes into like this small sample size and go, oh, well, he's just been bad. Like,
yeah.
No, I'll give Tyrese Maxey minutes. My question back to you is, you were so super stoked at George Hill when he was acquired. when will the real George Hill show up in the series?
Defensively, he's been
good,
but yeah, offensively they're gonna need more from him. It's been weird. It's like you get after game one, Shake Milton came to work out, I think the night before game two, and then he explodes, and then after game two, Korkmaz worked out after the game, and now he explodes in game three. So I think we just need the report of which reserve worked out either after game three or before game four. Was it George Hill or was it Tyrese Maxey? Because that's who's going to blow up unexpectedly. I'm with you, though, starting Korkmaz. I originally thought, like, as soon as Danny went down, I'm like, oh, okay, well, now they can put Matisse in the starting lineup and you can have Ben on Trey and Matisse on Bogdan. But then I'm realizing, one, you're giving Trey a place to hide. You can put him on Matisse and he can hide defensively. And two, if, God forbid, one of those guys gets into foul trouble, as Matisse fouled out in 17 minutes last night, all of a sudden you're like out of backup options. I mean, Danny was not playing particularly well in this series, but he was at least a body who you could throw, especially at Bogdanović. So I think Korkmaz, I think he will keep starting for the spacing reasons, because like Trey can't hide on him, and they were going at Trey specifically last night in a way they hadn't in the first two games. I do wonder if Bogdanović, you know, if Korkmaz is defending Bogdanović, if that is just like absolute green light takeover, you know, Trae Young is being smothered by Ben Simmons, so Bogdanović is going to be like, all right, I'm dropping 35 tonight.
Yeah, absolutely. I think now we can finally talk about him, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what they need at this point. I think, you know, Trey has been still effective, but just not as effective as he was in game one. I think they need, like, a Bogdanović takeover game.
They might get it.
Yeah.
He's good. And this is what I was kind of talking about with the whole 16-player thing.
Yes.
He's a playoff guy.
Yeah.
Like, I tweeted last night, oh, God. See, I've had so many different days. It was last night, the game, right? Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
That I didn't understand why there weren't more teams that aggressively went after Bogdanović.
Or why the Kings didn't match his very reasonable offer sheet.
And, of course, the Bucks as well. But, like, 20 teams should have gone after Bogdanović.
Yeah.
I think there were a lot of skepticism around him because he played with the Kings, and he got... apologies, Kings fans, but like he got the stink of the Kings on him, and people were like, "Nah, like we don't really dare do that." And then he just like reminded everyone, "Hey, look, I dominated overseas.
Right,
I'm that good. I'm that guy."
I think that's the problem, is you don't know how he's going to translate to the playoffs because he played for the Kings, so you never got to see him in the playoffs. But exactly. Now, but I mean, you could look at his skill set and realize, oh, this guy makes sense as a playoff player. John Collins, on the other hand.
Oh, I was waiting for this one. I've been doing all the John Collins slander on this podcast, I feel, over the last year. So I am very, very happy to finally be joined by my buddy Brian on this one. So I'm going to just sit back. And I'm going to hear all the slander that I have provided over the past year, and I'm going to relay it all to you.
I don't want to slander him, because if you look at his, like, if you just looked at the box score, you'd be like, oh, yeah, he's averaging 17-7 and shooting 62% overall, 43 from three.
Yeah, that's what I've been saying. So come on, bring it. Bring it, Big Papa.
But he just is getting roasted by Tobias Harris defensively. And it, like, Trey is just setting up so much. He is not creating these shots by himself. Like, a lot of his efficiency is because he's just dunking home lobs.
Right.
Like, I'm just...
And Brian, is he creating off the dribble?
No. No, he is not.
Is he playmaking for others?
No. He has three total assists. I'm getting a semi.
Keep talking, Brian.
Yeah, I don't want to call him rich man's Lauri Markkanen, because that's not fair to him. I think he is a much better player than Markkanen, but this does keep hearkening back to this discussion of, you know, I don't want to call him a traditional power forward because he can hit the three ball pretty well. But
well, traditional over the past 10 years.
Yeah, but would I pay John Collins a max contract this offseason, which I'm sure some team is at least going to consider? Absolutely hell no. And I think this series, if nothing else, regardless of how it goes moving forward for the Hawks, this should be enlightening to them, because it can at least confirm, like, all right, this is our first taste of playoff basketball, and John Collins just does not fit with our best version of ourselves.
And you know why as well? When you have two guys on the court who needs to be set up consistently in Capella and Collins.
Yeah.
That means you lose out on versatility.
Yes.
That means that you have two guys you can very easily take out of the game. The starting power forward moving forward, power forward, I'm putting that in quotation marks, should be, when he's healthy next year, DeAndre Hunter.
Yes.
That is guy moving forward. Yes. I was going over this with a couple of guys who are really into both contracts and player evaluations and all that. And, like, I made the point that, just to piggyback off your Markkanen point, like, just in terms of what Markkanen provides, I would not pay him more than around $7.5 million per year. Obviously, he's going to get more because the NBA is all about upside and hype and whatnot. But he's just not a guy you should pay significantly more than that at all.
Mm-hmm.
And Collins, I think, should top out at around 12 to 14 million. And people are going to be like, are you crazy? He scored over 20 points a year ago, 10 plus rebounds. Like, he's a guy who can hit 40% from the free, high efficiency scoring. Yeah, that's all true. But in order to do all that, he needs to have an elite playmaker alongside him. So do you want to pay him as someone who is capable of doing these things on his own, which he's not?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you want to pay him accordingly and then let his value increase by having him play alongside an elite playmaker? Like, he can go to Dallas and play with Luka, in which case he would be a 2010 guy again. That's fine. But if Luka goes down, you know, that stat line is going to revert into something that's not pretty.
Yeah.
He is completely reliant upon others. So is Markkanen. So is a lot of these, like Marvin Bagley as well. These guys should not be attractive on the restricted free agency market. I know Bagley has a year to go, but you catch my drift there.
Yes.
Like, if you are fully reliant upon others to be productive, your value should go all the way down. Like, we know that in the playoffs, self-creation and creation for others is absolute key offensively. So if you can't do that, either one of them, how can you justify giving those guys like 15, 20, 25 max dollars? You can't. There's no way you can do that. So if a team throws out the max for John Collins, oh boy, Brian, I mean, then you and I are going to have a very long episode.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I mean, this isn't to say anything about how the rest of the series, like, much like the Nuggets, the Hawks, one, they're playing with house money anyway, because they just getting out of the first round, especially where they were halfway through the season. This is a great building block season for them. And they don't have, Collins is their big decision to make. We'll touch on that again and the by Felicia. But I'm with you. DeAndre Hunter is a modern day four. He's perfect for this team. Not having him, he's out for the series because of a meniscus injury, which sucks for them because he would be so crucial for this team right now. They're also without Cam Reddish. You know, if you run out next year, Trae Young, Bogdanovich, Cam Reddish, DeAndre Hunter, Clint Capella.
with Onyeka Okongwu as your backup big.
And Gallinari and Kevin Herter off the bench as well. Like,
yeah,
that is a hell of a rotation. Like, the Hawks are really building something here, so I don't want this to be misconstrued as, like, me taking a victory lap, because they could still come back and win this series. It's only, they're only up 2, you know, Sixers are only up 2-1, but I, like...
Oh, that's not what you told me before we started recording.
I mean, I think the Sixers are going to win this series, but the Hawks still could, hypothetically, but either way,
fair enough.
Either way, I wouldn't be bummed if I'm a Hawks fan. Like, yeah, you know, you want to go as far as you can, but, like, you're not going to win the title this year. But you've got some really good pieces in place, and now you're getting clarity about John Collins, which is great. The other question I have for the Hawks before we get to the Olshay stuff, so they've, because Hunter is out, they've started Solomon Hill for 3 straight games. Solomon Hill has shot 2 of 11 from the field, has scored 7 total points. He has as many personal fouls as he does points in this series. They went with Tony Snell as the starter in the second half last night. He is 0 for 3 in this series with 0 points, but 3 personal fouls. So those options have not been great. If you are Nate McMillan, Mort, what do you do ahead of game 4? Do you stick with the same starting lineup, or do you move one of Gallo, Lou Williams, or Kevin Herter into the starting lineup?
I definitely get Kevin Herter in there. Look, Solomon Hill played over, I think, I looked this up the other day. Yeah, over 1,500 minutes in the regular season. Given just how deep the Hawks were on the wing and the guard spots coming into the season, that's about 1,500 minutes more than Solomon Hill should have played at all this year.
Yeah, to be fair, and injuries played a big part of that. Like, Hunter missed a lot of time. Like, that's,
That's what I'm saying. Like, because of injuries, this is where we are.
Yeah.
Right. But that does not mean it's a great option. Like, he was a guy who was signed to just, you know, in case of emergency, you can use him in a little bit. We're looking at an emergency, but over 71 games in the regular season, he shot 35.9% from the field.
Yeah.
He is not a shot maker. This is, once again, a PJ Tucker situation, only the difference here being he's not as good a defender. Like, what does he give you, Brian, if anything?
Nothing. He gives the Sixers a place to hide Seth Curry.
Yes. And defensively, like, he's not much of a... Like, he's decent, he can switch around and all that, but, like, he's not great.
No.
Like, he's not going to set the world on fire defensively. Like, you can go at him and you can get buckets on him.
Yes.
Like, Tobias Harris against Solomon Hill, like, go Tobias. Like,
and Ben last night. We saw aggressive Ben coming out in the second half last night. It was I mean, it was a night and day. Like, he just refused to even look at the basket in the first half, and all of a sudden Doc calls him out at halftime. He's like, all right, I'll assert my force on the series. So yeah, I'm with you though. I would definitely start Kevin Herter. Similar to, you know, what I'm saying with Solomon Hill gives them a place to hide Curry, and, like, with Young, and if you could start Matisse Thybulle or Korkmaz, start Korkmaz so Young can't hide, start Kevin Herter so Curry can't hide.
Right.
Like, I know Nate McMillan has said he likes Herter coming off the bench, but I don't care. Like, you still have Gallo and Lou Williams to anchor your bench units, and also it's the goddamn playoffs. You shouldn't be playing 10 men when you're, you know, when your options are Solomon Hill and Tony Snell. Just shorten your rotation and play your best players more. Because you're already...
And that was going to be my next point, because I want them to play Gallo more. I want them to play Kevin Huerter more. Like, Gallo is not even playing 25 minutes per game. Up the minutes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Also, by the way, can we get a trade between Gallo and Dwight's Mohawks?
Oh, God. No, Dwight's been rocking that all year.
I love it. Yeah. It looks like French fries.
It's so bad. Yeah, I mean, personnel-wise, the Hawks are at a deficit because they don't have Huerter in the Hunter in the series. But it does feel like Doc has at least pushed more of the right buttons than Nate has. And I'm really curious to see, especially since Doc's going to have to adjust his starting lineup because of the Danny Green injury, how Nate McMillan responds. How they figure out. I mean, they have no answer for Joel Embiid whatsoever. They threw like triple teams at him. He had 8 assists. Like, he had a Jokic game, but he was also incredible on defense last night. So, you know, Embiid is just an impossible riddle for them to solve. But if Tobias keeps playing as well as he has and Ben Simmons plays like he did in the second half last night, I don't know. I mean, it's similar to the Wizards series where you just don't have the defensive forwards to guard these guys, and they do have the defensive personnel to guard you. So, you know, I think I said Sixers in 7 before. I would lean Sixers in 6 now. I think we do get Bogdanovich blow up game. It could happen in game 4, but I don't know. It feels like Philly's a minus 650 right now. Hawks are a plus 480. So odds makers, after last night's game, really seemed to get on board with Philly.
Did Seth Curry listen to us, by the way?
Because he's actually shooting in the high volume, finally?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's been awesome. He has been
It great. Has! This is what I've been saying, though. Like, we could all have had this Seth Curry all year long.
Yeah. Yeah, shooting 60%
from 3. Just take more shots away from Danny.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Let's wrap up with Neil Olshay, who we recorded the By Felicia for Portland, believe last Sunday.
Yeah. Neil Olshay, a couple days before the meltdown.
Yeah, so he gives a press conference a few days afterward in which he just ran Terry Stotts over, the corpse of Terry Stotts over with a bus at least 15 times. He said,
yep.
Quote, the first round loss and the defensive rating at 29 was not a product of the roster. He said about, you know, their next head coach. He said, the mission is clear. If we're going to take the next step, they're going to have to make an impact on the defensive end of the floor. Just overall, super defensive about kind of the moves that he was making. Didn't really seem to take any accountability for some of his past decisions that didn't pan out, specifically Derek Jones Jr. this year. And, you know, to me, it just felt like when you fire the coach and if nothing changes, the next guy on the chopping block tends to be the GM. Right. So it felt like Olshay was preemptively getting defensive because he knows his seat is warming up considerably. But what did you make of that presser, Mort?
Oh, it was a train wreck. Absolute train wreck. I remember going through it like on Twitter as well and like both seeing the comments and like finding a feed. And oh my God, Ryan. It was like, look, here's the thing. If Damian Lillard was not on the phone with his people during the middle of that press conference, I'd be shocked. I'd be utterly shocked. So Olshay also said that any new coach would basically have to adapt with what they have or use what they have, mm-hmm. suggesting further, like, I'm not going to make changes. This is a guy who doubled down on drafting a bust in Myers Leonard by re-signing him to a $41 million contract. And like, there was no reason for it, because Myers Leonard obviously was not the kind of player who would justify having that type of contract. He is so in his own, like, ego at this point. that I just cannot imagine that he will at any point for the rest of his Blazers tenure go out there and go, okay, let's see what we can do, team first approach. This is all about saving his own ass. This is all about saving his own ego. This is all about him, and it shouldn't be because he's not on the out on the court making jump shots. Like, I think Neil Olshay's presence in with the Portland Trail Blazers is going to put a significant ceiling on what they can achieve as a group or as a unit. Like, Dame wants changes. We know this. Mm-hmm. And you're insinuating that no changes outside of a new coach is going to be made? Like, I think Dame is on the phone with his people. I don't think he's made any trade request public, but I absolutely think that he's made it privately.
Yeah, I'm still not there.
That's fine. But that you can agree with me that that's a train wreck of a press conference.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Like he should be dismayed by that, especially. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that the first sign of a healthy organization, or just really anyone in your career, like if you F up, the first thing you should do is analyze what went wrong and how can you improve, and you need to take accountability for your mistakes. So. When you spend the full mid-level on Derek Jones Jr. and he does not play much at all in a first-round series loss to a team without its second-best player, you need to say, okay, that didn't pan out. Why didn't it? Like, what do we need to evaluate moving forward? The trade for Norman Powell, it worked out to some extent, but now we're at a spot where Norman Powell is going to be an unrestricted free agent, and we're going to have to overpay him to retain him, most likely. Like, I don't think we're getting a discount on Norman Powell. Was the process sound in all of these decisions? Was it sound to acquire Robert Covington for the cost that we did? Was it sound not to consider trading CJ McCollum at the trade deadline when he was coming back from the injury? I think you could probably poke holes in all of those things. And as you said, I mean, this is not limited to this year. He's had oversight of this roster for almost a decade now. So he's made plenty of mistakes in the past as well. But, yeah, I mean, I think not taking accountability should at least have Dame's antenna up a little bit. But at the same time, this is a roster that's gone to the playoffs, you know, how many straight years now? Like, they were in the Western Conference Finals a couple of years ago. This isn't a Bradley Beal Wizard situation where it's like they are so mired in mediocrity that there is no feasible way they're going to win a championship in Bradley Beal's tenure. And, you know, Dame has been hammering home that I'm loyal to Portland. I want to play my whole career in Portland. Like, I don't think one press conference changes that for him. But
no, but he was already on edge.
Yeah, I mean, I think that plants another seed of doubt in his mind about whether he can accomplish his goal of winning a title in Portland.
Yes, and that's kind of what I'm leaning at here.
Yeah.
Because he's no spring chicken either. He's not 22 or 24 anymore.
Yeah. But I don't think he's like gone to his people and said, even secretly, like, let's get me out of here this offseason. I don't think.
No, I think they've had conversations. I think that kind of presser, at the very least, someone got a phone call. Like, whoa, are you seeing this? Are you listening to this?
But like,
the hell?
The Blazers will just fire Olshay before they even entertain Dame trades.
See, that's the thing, man. I mean, yeah, you would think so. You would absolutely think so. But at the same time, like, we have seen this behavior around the league before. And then it's like players going, no, you know what? I don't want to do this. And then they actually end up leaving.
Yeah.
Where ownership should basically come in and go, no, you know what? You're the player. You're far more important.
Right.
Let's make you stick here. Like, if I was an owner, if I owned the Portland Trailblazers and my GM went out and said the things that he said, after having the history that he's had by constantly trying to feed his own ego, you know what? I'm firing him.
Yeah. Or I'm at least like, that would be the conversation I'd be having. Not, you know, Dame not necessarily demanding a trade, but Dame calling the Allen ownership family and being like,
yeah,
are we sure this guy is the right person to lead our organization?
That I can get behind. If that's the thinking, instead of a trade request, all good.
Yeah.
I just don't think, in no way, shape, or form, does Neil Olshay come out of this looking good.
Oh, no.
In no way. Like, this is just... And this is really one of those situations where you just feel this is an old man yelling at a cloud.
Yeah.
I didn't do anything.
Yeah.
It's all everyone else. Like, rah, rah, rah. And Dame is like, dude, I'm getting older.
Yeah.
I need to win. Like, right now. It's like the perfect storm of things culminating within a couple of weeks. So, to me, I wouldn't be shocked if Dame is just like, nope, that's last straw, final. I want something else. If that's a trade, fine. If it's, I want a new GM, I want a new roster, okay. Then we can look at it through that frame. But then you also have to ask, how long does it take to actually build something up around him? Because you have to do that quickly.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, they have some flexibility, at least in terms of players who other teams should want. But I could at least like see the foundation of this is where things start to break apart. I just don't think we're there quite yet. And I'm not ready. You know, Dame's under contract, guaranteed contract for at least three more seasons. He has a $48.8 million player option in 2024-25. So it's not like the Wizards with Bradley Beal, who we talked about in the last episode or two episodes ago, I believe.
Yeah.
You know, where it's like, he's under contract for one more year. He is a legit flight risk. If you don't move him, you could be losing this superstar for nothing next year. Like, the Blazers aren't there yet, but we are definitely at the point. Like, that loss to a depleted Nuggets team, especially seeing how badly they're losing to the Suns right now, that is a wake-up call to Portland. Like, not only were we not good enough, we were nowhere. We were sniffing no semblance of being a top-tier team. And, you know, that Western Conference Finals run was great and it was fun. It's also in the past, and we have backslid ever since. So we need to figure out something and figure it out quickly because, yes, you know, three more years sounds like a lot, but we've seen in the NBA time moves very quickly, especially with superstars.
I'm just saying Dame is going to be 31 next month.
Yeah.
Time is ticking.
Yeah. Well, on that happy note, I think that's a good place for us to head out. So thank you all, as always, for listening. Please follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. We're being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. And thanks for listening to our live show on Locker Room. If you liked our show, please be sure to start your own room and engage with other fans on the app. Download the Locker Room app in the Apple App Store to be a part of our podcast. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined, as always, by Morten Jensen. Have a good one, Mort.
You too, Brian. Take care, man.